Do you think you'd never be targeted with disinformation? Well, remember hearing about those new Australian road rules? Curfews for drivers over 60 and mandates to keep your lights on. That was actually an AI disinformation campaign. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist, and I've been learning that online tactics just like this are being used regularly to seed mistrust in government decision-making. You can join me as I interrogate the world of mis and disinformation. Stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Tanya Heaslip was sitting in a pub in London in 1989 when she saw the Berlin Wall come down on the telly. Tanya was at the tail end of a solo backpacking trip, which didn't quite match the expectations of the Europe she'd dreamt up in her head as a kid growing up on a remote cattle station near Alice Springs. So looking for some excitement, Tanya jumped on a plane to Berlin the very next day, which began an obsession and a fascination with finding out about life behind the old Iron Curtain, as it was. Several years later, Tanya returned to Europe, this time to the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia, as it was then. And there in fairytale Prague, not long after the Velvet Revolution, Tanya saw all these unexpected parallels between the magic and isolation of Prague and that of Central Australia, their people and their stories. And Tanya entered into a relationship with an older man who had very different ideas about love and friendship. Tanya Heaslip is the author of several memoirs, including Alice to Prague and Alice Girl and Beyond Alice. Dobry den, Tanya. Hello.
Dobry den, Richard. Jak se masz? I hope you're well.
You grew up, as I said, on the family's cattle station, a remote part of the Northern Territory. How big a part was beef in the daily diet of people out on the station?
Breakfast, lunch and dinner. It was beef all day long in every way, every guise that could be cooked. It was, you know, salted, roasted, stewed, and we had rib bones just as soon as we got our fresh meat and they were on the barbecue. They were delicious. Every way you could have beef all day long.
Did this mean you went out and caught and killed your own beef to eat?
Yes. That's how everybody lived back then. You sort of lived off the land, literally, and ours was a cattle station. So we kids would go out with Dad to get a killer, as it was called.
You go out with your dad, you'd be part of that as kids?
Yeah, absolutely. We were the workers. So we're on the back of the Land Rover. Dad's got his gun, his 22 rifle, selects a killer, one of the best-looking cattle out on the flat, brings it down with one shot, and then we kids had to rush and get all the branches and lay them on the ground and help the men carve up the beast out there on the flat and then put the quarters back on the back of the Land Rover and hold them on the long rattly drive back to the homestead. And in between, we got the lungs and blew them up and, kids out in the bush, we just made our own fun and didn't even think this was weird.
You butchered it in situ in the open air, out in the open air like that.
Yes, yeah, and we were busy kids, we had to get mulga branches and continually wave them over the carcass to keep the flies off and to keep it as safe as possible from the elements.
If you're a meat eater, when you talk to city friends, do they go, "Oh, that's horrifying," or something? Do they get a bit worried about that?
Absolutely. It was such a normal thing. I didn't even realise it was a strange way to get your own meat until probably I went to uni and really started hearing from city folk that this was odd. They went to the butcher or the supermarket and didn't even know really how the meat got there.
Right, it just sort of arrived somehow magically under the cling wrap. Yeah.
If they ate meat at all.
Tell me about that country near Alice Springs. Oh. I've been out there. Just can you describe what it looks like, what it sounds like, what it smells like?
Oh, it's just magnificent. Huge blue skies, enormous red rocky ranges. They're the McDonald Ranges that run east to west. They're enormous and they're ancient and craggy, and there's this big split between them that the dry Todd River runs through where Alice Springs is situated. It's usually dry. The Todd's full of water at the moment, but we've had rain. But the smell, that dry air of the desert, and then the eucalypt from the gum trees along the creek beds, and the sound of crickets and cicadas at night, stars, huge starry skies. It's just magical. It's a very mystical ancient land.
It's hard to describe what the air feels like in the outback. And that's a strange thing to say what the air feels like, but it feels distinctly different than it does in coastal Australia. I don't know, you sense the expanse of the world and the quietness of it and the dryness of the air, and you feel like it sort of goes like that all the way up into space or something. Just space and expanse is the feel I get when I'm out there.
It's a very good description. You're in the middle of nowhere. You're 1,600 k's to the south and to the north from any other major city, more to the east and west. There's just nothing. There's hundreds and hundreds of miles of space and emptiness in this ancient indigenous land. And this land was once the bottom of the sea. So it's so old. And all these ranges that are craggy and folded have been folded by the geology of time. And it feels ancient and isolated. And there's such an insignificance to yourself as a person standing in that land, and yet such a huge connection to what's greater than you.
I tend to amuse people when I'm out there because I can't walk two steps without wanting to take a photo or take in a scene or something, because it's so majestic and astonishing and beautiful. Like every one scene after another unfolds before your eyes, and you can't believe how beautiful and weirdly beautiful it is to someone who's grown up on the coast like me. But to people who live there, it's just, I don't know, part of the warp and weft of everyday life. Do you have to go away and come back to appreciate it, or do you appreciate it as a kid growing up?
I loved it as a kid. I didn't know it was unusual. We were so isolated. This was the 60s and 70s. We didn't go anywhere, and we only had two-way radio for communication with the outside world. There was no television. But it was definitely, it was then so imbued in me as this place where I felt strong and whole, that when I went away and went to different places, I never felt that sense of wholeness and strength. And it was going back there. I was like, yes, my feet are back on this red earth. I'm looking at those magnificent white gum trees that rise up into the blue sky. There's a wholeness and a strength I feel when I'm back there.
Now, this isn't desert, but it is semi-arid. What kind of wildlife are you constantly running into out there?
Oh, well, roos, constant kangaroos everywhere. But the most gorgeous ones are the little wallabies, the rock wallabies that live in all the gorges and anywhere along the top of hillsides, just these sweet little rock wallabies, and they scuttle away when they see you, but they're very curious and they rarely come out during daytime, just at dawn. You see them when you're out walking at dawn. Then, of course, there's the predator, the dingo, who has no natural predator above it. So they're the wolves, they're the wild creatures there that the rock wallabies hide from as well.
And what are the birds there? Because I have these images in my mind of flocks of white birds. And what are they, cockatoos?
Flocks and flocks of cockatoos, wild, or galahs, cockies, whatever you want to call them, the farmer's curse. There's squillions of them there, packs of them squawking and screeching, crows, of course. And we also have the red and green parrots, lots and lots of them, which are gorgeous. I'm not quite as screechy. We have butcher birds that sing in the morning that are just divine. We have little babblers. And then when it rains, we have flocks of tiny wrens, loads of them, just all over the waterholes.
So growing up there in the 60s and 70s, say, what was daily routine like for your mum and dad?
Work, just non-stop work. They were up at 5 to turn on the old generator to get the electricity going so mum could have a light to cook masses of meat and eggs from our chooks for breakfast for all the stockmen, for us kids. Then mum would spend all day cooking because there'd be morning smoko, afternoon smoko. She'd use baking trays to cook cakes that would be devoured in one setting. So mum's day was basically providing for all that. We had up to 30 people living there at any one time. And then dad's was out with the cattle on horseback, mustering, drafting, trucking. They were sort of like the classic division of roles of people on the land. Mum kept the homestead running, dad ran the property. And then we kids did all the work.
Like what kind of work?
Well, mustering cattle, we were the core of dad's stock camp. All bush kids are the core of their parents' stock
camp.
Like
from what age are you mustering cattle on horseback?
Oh, 6, 7. The minute we could ride, we were out. But even before we could ride, we were in the cattle yards, drafting cattle, watching cattle, feeding cattle, looking after the horses, fixing up fences, helping Dad with boars from as young as I can remember. We were in the back of the Land Rover off working.
See, I think I would imagine it's a life of isolation, but it sounds to me like you have like hordes of stockmen coming in and out of the house at all hours of the day. Is that right?
Well, they weren't always there because in the 60s and the 70s, the stock camp went out often for months on end. And so Mum would be having to prepare food and take it out. Then Dad got very smart and put in a lot of fences and more yards and more waters. So it meant that the stock camp wasn't out for as long. But our friends, as kids, we had the stockmen who were all older blokes. And then the horses, little joeys, little calves, potty calves, they were our friends for my sister and my two brothers and me. Yeah. And so life was horses and cattle and mustering when we weren't in the schoolroom doing correspondence school.
All sorts of people fetch up in that part of the world who find themselves unable to live in what I suppose we call suburbia or normal life.
Yeah. These were characters. They were almost all loner men. They were silent men. They lived with horses and cattle. They rarely spoke, but they were good to kids. They were so good to us. They'd have an old rolly and, you know, let us have a puff when Dad wasn't looking. They'd look after us when we fell off our horses. They were devoted to their horses and to cattle. They were the kind of men that, you know, you imagine of the old Henry Lawson, Banjo Paterson, Slim Dusty stories of sitting around a campfire at night on a swag, playing their guitars, singing all those old country songs.
Were some of them traumatised, like veterans or something, and men trying to recover in the outback?
Possibly, but as kids we didn't know that. They just sort of came from everywhere. But where we were, the majority were local stockmen, although there were some that came and went from all over. But it's interesting, they'd come out there and nobody talked about their background. I did not, as a child, know the background of any of the stockmen other than this wonderful guy, Charlie Gorry. We knew he came from Queensland and he seemed really old, but he wasn't that much older than us. They were mostly silent but very good men.
Tell me about one of them called Tommy Burrows.
Oh, God, Tommy was a great stockman. He had a terrible horse accident, injured his brain, was never the same. And so all the cattle stations around Alice took it in turns, taking him on for a couple of months and letting him come into the stock camp and helping. But he was a shocker. He'd chase us kids because we wouldn't eat his rabbit stew because it was always off. And he'd get the fry pan and go, "You kids," and he'd run down the flat after us.
What do you mean rabbit stew that was off? What do you mean, like, how off are we talking about
here? We're talking maggots. We'd run out of beef. What? So he caught a rabbit. We're in the stock camp and we had rabbit stew quite a few nights. And he was that wild because we wouldn't eat the last of his rabbit stew. He was a serious character.
So how did you communicate with the outside world living on that station back in those days?
Two-way radio, the Royal Flying Doctor Service. So that was based in Alice, and every morning there'd be what they'd call traffic, and through the base they'd have telegrams that would be read out to people on stations, and people on stations would call in with their telegrams, and then they'd have a medical session where the doctors would get on and talk to people out bush, and then they'd have School of the Air. And so we'd have half an hour each day, each grade, grade one to grade seven. So they were all sectioned out time frames. As soon as medical was over, on came School of the Air, and then medical and traffic would come again later in the day. And you'd find out what was happening on other stations by listening to people calling with, you know, what they needed or what was happening through telegrams.
I was really shocked by how bookish the culture is out in Central Australia. Maybe it's no longer the case because of, I don't know, satellite coverage and the bloody internet's there as well. But I don't know, in the day, everyone read books, didn't
yes.
they? And was that you?
The School of the Air had a little library. It was just a demountable on the back of the Royal Flying Doctor Service, but it had a little room full of books and people donated books. Now, they were all books set in the 30s and 40s. They were almost all Enid Blyton or Heidi, or, you know, they were all set in Europe. There were a couple of Colin Tierleys. But mostly they were European books, and Mum would go into town once a month to get the supplies, and she'd go to School of the Air and get a box full of books. I was very bookish, and that gave me this curiosity of the outside world and what was this overseas place like. I longed to know what these lands were that had snow-capped mountains and daffodil-strewn meadows and lakes. And
you know. That looked weird to you, I suppose, didn't it?
Well, it just, I'd never seen it, so I could only imagine it.
So, Tanya, at some points it was time to send you to boarding school. Mm. And this girl who's grown up in the outback who knows how to disembowel a cow, slaughtered cow, is going to a posh boarding school in Adelaide. Can I go out on a limb here and say it was probably awful to begin with?
Or? It was just hideous. It was hideous. I think most kids who go to boarding school at age 12, especially if you're a child of the outback and you know nothing about the outside world, you've never been in a classroom, you've never been in a city, you've never been in four walls of an institution. It was like being in prison. It was hideous.
And how about those nice Adelaide girls from nice homes, nice hams in Adelaide? How did they treat you as a rough as guts girl?
Well, yeah, and I was rough as guts. But interestingly, the boarders were all from South Australian country. So they were the girls I spent most of my time with. It was, you know, the day bugs, as we called them, in the classroom, didn't really mix with us. It took several years, I guess, before we started really intermingling, and they thought these rough as guts bush kids were okay to talk to. But the country kids were all, I mean, they were much better adapted anyway. They'd all been to, you know, mid-north schools and, you know, the
Coming there from Mount Gambier is a big difference than coming there from Central Australia, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. So I was an absolute fish out of water. We were in a dormitory, 14 girls, and a little window above my bed, and I'd look through it and I couldn't see the stars. And all I could hear was traffic on Green Hill Road. And I'd only seen night skies full of stars, and I'd never seen or spent time or gone to sleep next to a road full of traffic. And it was like being on another planet. Not being able to see the stars was traumatising for a bush kid.
What about the beach, though? Was Glenelg kind of a culture shock for you?
Yeah, Glenelg, I have never really much been into the beach since then.
So were you victimised a bit by the day girls at that school?
Not the day girls really were quite separate. They came to school. They all had these interesting packed lunches, and we'd have to go to the dining room for something. And then they'd all get on the tram or bus and go home. And so, no, but there were quite a few bullies in the boarding house. The boarding house was like a military system. You know, you crush the spirits of the kids, you get them till they're just a uniform mass, but there's always bullies in that kind of system, and especially if you had no social skills, which I didn't.
So you go from a life of freedom to one of constraint.
Yes.
You feel the walls around you a bit.
I was just used to running free. And also bush kids grow up from a very young age to do adult tasks, to be like my brother at age 11 was sent out at 3 a.m., 15 miles away to muster cattle and get them back to the station by dawn so they could be trucked and Dad was waiting. That's the kind of responsibility that, you know, bush kids were given. And in a boarding school, you're treated like just a naughty little girl who has no rights. It's very confronting as well.
So the friendships that you do make there, what's the nature of forming a friendship in that kind of strange, straitened world where you're feeling like the walls are closing in a bit?
It's very interesting. I think probably it's not the same, but it's akin to how you often hear soldiers talk in the army, akin to any kind of institution where you're pushed together and you're forced to survive and you need each other to survive. So ended up calling the bold band of boarders. We were like these young skittish fillies, you know, age 12, no parents, you know, lost in this institution, and we became each other's family very quickly. We're just all like sisters, and to this day those friendships are so strong and still there. And I see all the boarders, you know, quite often, and some of the day bugs now, which is great. But whenever I see them, it's like yesterday, because you have this foundation it's like you have with your own family, and it's so strong when you go through those kind of traumas.
You remember how you were when you were young and foolish together, that kind of thing? Those are very powerful relationships, aren't
they? Yeah, they are. And we'd be, oh my goodness, in first year we were all lined up by the headmistress because somebody had underlined sex in the dictionary. And we were lined up and the headmistress wagging her finger and telling us, girls, you will never marry, you will never be, you know, get on in this world if you are so disgusting. And we had to own up as to who'd done it, and we all stood there trembling in fear. No one owned up, and so we were gated for 2 weeks, which meant we couldn't leave the boarding house, couldn't go out anywhere. So when you go through that kind of stuff, age 12, and you don't even know what they're talking about, like, what was this headmistress on about?
Tanya, that's a crime against humanity, because it's a rite of passage in school to look dirty words up in the dictionary, and if it's something as innocuous as the word sex, then, wow, that's terrible. So what was your last night at boarding school like?
Ah, yes. Well, that was pretty wild because by then everyone had had enough and so lots of alcohol was smuggled in and there was a very wild party and girls got out on the roof and they were like, and smoking. It's like, what the hell? We're going home tomorrow. They can't do anything more to us now. But they could to the very last minute. The headmistress controlled us and came in and threatened to strip me and a number of others of our prefect badges. We had to ring our parents in her office and confess what we'd done. And then we went to the last valedictory service in shame and disgrace to the last minute, this school.
So you finish school, you go on, you become a lawyer.
Yeah.
And then in your late 20s, you quit. You walked away, you decided you wanted to travel. It sounds like you had this kind of Tolkien-like image of Europe from those little pictures in the School of the Air, a little magical little alpine peak and a nice cute little house on it and all the greenery and forest. And no, it wasn't, Europe's not like that, is it?
No, it's not like that. And I got a very rude shock because I'd harboured these images and longings since I was a little girl and I'd written stories about them and I'd read all these books, and yet Europe was full of freeways and towns and...
No, instead you're in some sort of awful place in Slough in England next to a traffic island with a wimpy bar underneath and the Ladbrokes or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. The closest I found was I hiked a lot through Switzerland and Austria and parts of the German forests, and that was the closest I came. But overall, at the end of the year, and I backpacked solo, much to my mother's horror, because you remember 89, you'd have to go into a little tobacco and get a card to ring home from a telephone box once a month or 2 months. But I made it to the end, and I was just very disillusioned. I'd found these beautiful places, but these childhood longings hadn't been assuaged, hadn't been fulfilled, and I didn't know why, and I thought I couldn't work out what I'd done wrong, and I didn't know what to do next.
Now, this is where our lives sort of kind of overlap, Tanya, because we get to the end of 89, November 89, and you and I, by the sound of things, were in the same place. We're both in London. We're both watching the Berlin Wall fall on television. It's like the most exciting thing in the history of the world.
Yes.
So you go and buy a plane ticket and go to Berlin. I did that, and you did that too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I was with a friend of mine from Adelaide Law School, Michael. He was living in London. I said, we've got to go tomorrow morning. He said, I can't. I've got a conference in Manchester. I said, Michael,
what?
This is the most exciting moment of our lives. So we went out.
Sorry. Michael missed on the Berlin Wall falling because he had a conference in Manchester?
He was prepared to, but it didn't happen. There was no way that was going to happen. We went into a phone box and he rang his boss and made some lame excuse. And we got the last two tickets on a plane into Berlin with all the world's media. It was so exciting. He didn't regret missing the conference.
When I got there, I went straight to the Berlin Wall, and even though it was about, oh, I don't know, at 9 o'clock at night, people were still chipping away chunks off very merrily. It was very, very merry. I got a chunk from that time I chipped my own thing out. What do you remember of the festive, joyous atmosphere at the time?
Well, it was overwhelmingly joyous, and I'd grown up with modern European history saying the evils of the Soviet era and the Soviet Union will remain forever. Nobody ever imagined that really this could happen. It was fairy tale. Like, there were people dancing on top of the wall, drinking champagne, the little, what they call those trabants, those
little cars.
Chugging through Checkpoint Charlie.
Yeah, they had lawnmower engines on them.
People running through, people hugging families who'd been separated by the wall for years. It was magical, and there was this very stern-looking soldier there, hobnail boots and grim, and he looked like he was in a place where he no longer had a job, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And I said, would you chip me out a bit of wall, please? Well, I couldn't speak in German, but he got the gist, and I got my bit of wall from him, and it was just life-changing because I thought, right, this shows history can change. This shows the you know, what you think is the great evil, the totalitarian regime, they can fall. And I just thought, right, I didn't know how my year was going to end. I'd been so disillusioned. And suddenly it was like, yes, I know what I want to do now. I want to get over that wall and see what's on the other side.
I've tried never to forget that lesson as well, that something you think is immobile and will stand and stand and go on forever can just go like that overnight.
Overnight.
Yeah. And in fact, it's all been it's been building up all along, but you just haven't quite seen it.
Exactly. Yes. Thousands of protests behind the Iron Curtain. So many people killed in jail. But of course, we didn't hear that or know that. So it seemed very fairy tale like to, you know, someone like me.
I visited a secret police prison in Potsdam, just outside of Berlin, East Berlin at the time. It was a hell of a time. To see the joyous atmosphere of that cloud lifting was just great.
Yes, of people's freedom. It really showed to me that the most important thing in life for human beings is that freedom, that choice, the capacity to live and choose your own life. Boarding school, the prisons, anywhere like that that crushes your spirit, totalitarian regimes, you see the joy in people when they feel free again and you think that's got to be the right way to live.
So after having that electrifying experience of the fall of the Berlin Wall, you went back to Central Europe a few years later, but this time to Czechoslovakia, which is now the Czech Republic. What was your plan at that time, Tanya?
To be honest, there wasn't much of a plan. There was, I'm desperate to see what's on the other side of that wall. I'm desperate to go any way I can. But this was the early 90s and I didn't know any way of doing that. So the plan, to the extent there was a plan, was that I just kept telling people I wanted to go. And eventually somebody knew somebody, and this barrister in Darwin, Peter Barr, by chance had been to Czechoslovakia and taught in a little town called Sedlčany, and he arranged for me to go there. So I went for 3 months to teach English at this high school in a country Czech town, knowing nothing. I wasn't a teacher. I didn't know how to teach a second language. I couldn't speak Czech. I knew nothing. I just said, thanks, Peter. Got a ticket, got my visa. The visa arrived 2 days before I left. I just jumped on a plane and went. It was all I wanted to do. I did not think how I would land.
Right. So you might have seen pictures of Prague, which is, I think, the most beautiful city in the world. Did you think Sedlčany was going to be like that? And what was the reality of Sedlčany when you got there?
Well, in my mind, Sedlčany was sort of Heidi, Switzerland, crossed with little villages across Switzerland and Austria. And I arrived to this very industrial town set in a valley filled with smokestacks where people got terrible bronchial diseases all the time, especially in winter, and about 8,000 people whose lives were still frozen, it felt, in time before communism had fallen. Now, this was 94, right at the start. Communism had only fallen 4 years before, and it was taking a very long time to recede from the thinking and the ways of life of people. So when I got to Sedlčany, it was a very rude shock because it was winter and it was dark and it was grey, it was depressing, I got really, really sick, and most people wouldn't look at me or talk to me because I was from the West and they were very suspicious of me.
My friends who lived through that time, before the fall of communism, said that you practiced something that they called inward migration. So you had this outward personality, which would sort of agree with everything the state told you, more or less, but inwardly you had your own life and maybe you'd share that with some friends if you could trust them.
Very private. When I got there, we arrived at 7 o'clock at night and the entire town was in darkness. So they turned off the lights at 7 o'clock every night. There was no television, there was no nothing. This was 4 years on and they were still doing it. Like they still had the big loud hailer in the main square where every day messages and lessons and orders and instructions were roared out to the community and people would stop all over the town to listen to this. It was as though time had not moved on. Luckily for me, in the school, there were some really progressive teachers and they were the ones who had the courage to go from inward living to also outward looking, and they welcomed me, and that's what made it possible. But for the rest of the town, there was so much fear. There was just fear of showing anything, speaking to a foreigner in any way, engaging in any way that could get them into trouble.
But what about your students? Were they curious about you and where you'd come from? And what on earth could you tell them about where you'd come from as a Alice Springs girl?
Exactly. And bear in mind, this is pre-internet. This is pre-everything, pre-mobile phones. they knew nothing about Central Australia. But it was exciting meeting them because they were so curious and interested and untainted by the world, untainted by the West. Their life was around Settlechani, their family, their friends, the nature. They spent all their time in the nature whenever they could. And they asked questions. They wanted to know. They were unfiltered. They hadn't yet been sufficiently impacted, I guess, at least the older ones that who knew a little bit of English. And they wanted to know stories. And I just felt this extraordinary kinship with them because they reminded me of me growing up in the outback, where I too was completely innocent of the outside world. And when people came to visit, so curious, so interested, who were they? So I had that. I felt like I really understood them. They were wonderful kids.
There was a culture there of making your own fun too,
yes.
When only there were only certain kinds of approved entertainment and approved culture that you could go into.
Yes.
So did you relate to that as well?
Totally. So luckily for me, growing up with all those stockmen sitting around a campfire playing guitar, singing songs, the first idea I had was to pick up a guitar because they all played music. The school was full of instruments. So I got a guitar and I taught them all Waltzing Matilda because I thought that's a way to connect with them, tell them about this, you know, all the curious animals of our culture and thinking that, you know, jumbuck and swaggy and billabong might be useful terms when they grew up and got to the West. And through that music, we just connected, you know, heart to heart because music does that. You don't need words. And so all the kids who couldn't speak English joined in, and then it grew and it grew. And so I started teaching them songs and they started teaching me songs.
Is there a particular quality to the way friendship works in such a place that you recognised?
Yes, I think so. And that's what made it so dear. These places where you're very isolated and you only have each other. And I was incredibly lonely because nothing in Settlechani was in English. There was nothing. The two English words I could find were again sex and polizzi, which meant police. This was a language that I could not relate to. It's that connection of being isolated and then just being really curious about what is it that makes people here and nature for them, fashioned them, shaped them. They quoted poetry, they wrote stories, they wrote songs, they played music. There's something about that friendships are built in that kind of maybe a vacuum or a void.
And your fellow teachers, did you make friends amongst them as well?
Yes, yes. The ones that were outward looking, there were a number there that did not want to engage, didn't trust me.
The Czechs can be maddeningly insular at times.
Yes, every morning recess was somebody's name day because all the saints, every day is a saint's day in Czechoslovakia, and so everybody was connected to a saint, so they had their birthday and their saint day. And so every recess was bringing out the guitars and the vodka and the slivovica and the bekarovka and anything else that they could put their hands to. And they would drink all through recess and talk about the football, their local football, their neighbours, what was happening around them, the nature. And to the extent I could infiltrate that, I did. It was mostly through the music. But, yeah, otherwise, they were a small village in a south of Prague in an area that was still really controlled by a sense of communism.
I find their pub life to be a lot like Australian pub life. I really like it. I feel very comfortable and very at home. There's the similar kind of beer drinking, merry, leg pulling sort of culture that we have in Australia as well. I find the culture is very similar to ours and I feel very comfortable in that. Do you feel the same?
Yes. And it's because a bit like London, the UK generally, where people lived in very small apartments, the pub would be where they would go to meet their friends. It's where they'd go and have dinner if they want to go out. It wasn't let's go out somewhere. It was we live in this tiny apartment, we want to see our friends. We go down to the pub. There was always a guitar. There was very often a fire in winter time. In summer, the windows would be open and you'd have all the beautiful birdsong outside. And then you didn't order a beer, a pivo. You'd sit there and they just bring it comes to you. You have to wave it away. And if you don't want it, you don't order water. That costs three times as much as a pivo. And they still do in some places. I think they just have these little square pieces of paper. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like Dad used to count cattle. And the beer, I wasn't much of a beer drinker until I went to Prague. But after that, I was a convert.
So eventually your friends took you to Prague. And you go to Fabled Fairy Tale Park, and that is that what you've been looking for all along?
Yes. It's fabled. It's magical. This was what I was looking for. This is where I'm meant to be.
I think what you feel like you're coming home to is the fairy tales of your childhood.
And I looked everywhere for it and couldn't find it. And here it was, protected, bizarrely, by the Iron Curtain, untainted by the West.
So you met a man in Prague named Karel. Tell me about this man, Karel.
He quoted poetry, he played songs on his guitar, he had
Right. Wow.
That guy. He used to tell jokes all the time about the old regime. He was so charming and he was so greatly loved, and I just felt incredibly safe with him. And he invited me to come and stay with him, and I wasn't sure about that, but then I discovered actually this free-spirited, fun guy was actually a grandfather. He had daughters and...
A grandfather?
A grandfather. He had two daughters and a daughter. They all married very young in Czechoslovakia, and he'd been divorced for many, many years. And one of his daughters lived with him and another lived nearby. So his family was there. So I thought, oh, this is probably safe. And I just went there. He said, you can stay with me until you find work, if that's what you wish. And so I found work at what was called English House. And then I said, I'd better leave, Karel. And he said, you can stay here for as long as you wish. And so I never left.
So you moved into his place. Was it the kind of beautiful, funky apartment in the old town that you imagined, or was it a panelaki, the communist housing blocks?
It was absolutely the latter. This huge panelaki suburb and a tiny little apartment where there wasn't really room for me, but they were so generous and welcomed me in. And I really did think, no, I'm going to get out of here as soon as I can and find one of those old town apartments. That's where I want to be to fulfil the dream. But they were a bit beyond my budget, I soon discovered.
Were you in love with each other, you two?
Yeah, I fell completely madly in love with him. I later learned that, yes, he did feel the same, but he refused to tell me. He showed it in every way, but he had this view that I was this young Australian girl, and I was younger than him, and that I would go back to Australia where I could properly have my career, and that if I did that, he would be broken. And he said, this would not be good for either of us, and you will go. And But at that time, being madly in love, and I was 31, I was like, I'm going to stay here forever. And he somehow knew that that ultimately wouldn't be the case. But he was wonderful. And, yeah, I had this amazing 2.5 years with him.
Do you mean he knew that you were of Central Australia and he was very much of Prague? Neither of you could completely leave where you were from? Is that what he meant?
I think so. His friends, Misha and Yada, these two Czech Australians who'd brought me to Prague and introduced me to Karel, had been to the outback. They'd told him about it. He had a real sense of what it was. And he'd had the chance to escape in 1968 after the Prague Spring with them, and he couldn't. He said, I cannot leave my country and my family. And that was Karel. He was wedded to Prague, to the nature, to his land, to the music, to his family, and he would never move. And I think he had the thought that, he said to me, I cannot ever leave here and go to Australia with you. And he said, and you will not ultimately stay here because you're too young and you'll want to get back to law one day.
There's a lot of truth in what he says. A lot of the people who did flee Prague, Czechoslovakia, after the 68 invasion were heartbroken by it. There were many who ended up in Canada, the United States, and plenty who ended up here who couldn't quite let go but couldn't return either. And many of them told me they lived their lives feeling like they were in exile.
Yes, that grief of a foot in both camps. They didn't ever belong in either place.
And they felt embittered too.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So there was probably some wisdom in what Karel told you.
They'd lost who they were. They'd lost their titles, their rights, their skill sets. And Karel was very aware of that. He was incredibly wise. And I was so, honestly, so naive. I really thought absolutely love could conquer all, that my love of Prague and of him and that life would be enough. And he'd lived long enough and seen enough. He'd seen so much sadness. He'd seen so much loss, and he'd seen how people had suffered.
The other thing that people suffered over there was the constant treachery of love and friendship. And the secret police archives were uncovered. They found that everyone had been informing on everyone else.
Yeah.
So what did that do to his view of love then, Karel? What did he even believe in love?
He said he didn't. He said, I do not believe in love. I have seen too much pain. And because nobody could trust anybody else, like you loved somebody only to be betrayed by them, that meant what was left? A bitterness, a lack of trust. He exhibited love in everything he did, in the way he lived. He restored buildings in Prague, old buildings. That was his job, and he was just wonderful at it. But he could not trust, ultimately. He'd been, I think, burnt too much, seen too much.
But you were in love with him, and to hear him say he didn't believe that love was real, did that kind of dishonour your feelings in your mind? I mean, how do you feel when he says something like that to you in regards to what you're feeling in that moment?
Well, it was terrible. He would say, love is for nothing. It is for nothing. It goes. It does not last. It is for nothing. And, it was a really, really terrible time internally. But I found a Czech psychiatrist who spoke English. This wonderful woman I worked for at the Ministry of Justice, Mrs. Falstova, she said, Tanichko, you must go and talk to this man. And he really helped me. He said, you have to honour your own feelings. And if they don't match the person you love, then it's not right for you. And that is that. He was, you know, pragmatic. He said, the Czechs are nothing if not pragmatic. And so ultimately, you know, I came to realise that even though I knew I'd always loved Kardel, I would never be able to live there long term because I wanted more, and he knew that I wanted more.
So you came back to Australia. What became of Kardel? How did you next hear about him?
Well, I went back to Prague a lot. Like, I left, and then I'd just go back, and I'd go back, and I'd see him each time, just a little bit less each time. Then I met my husband, who is the most wonderful man in the world, and we were living in Margaret River in WA. And I got a phone call from Misha. So Misha and Yada, the two Czech Australian men who introduced me to Kardel, and they said, Kardel has cancer. And I hadn't seen him then for a couple of years, and I couldn't believe it. And they said he's shut off all contact with everyone. And I managed to find this old card on which he'd written his mobile number when he got a mobile phone. After I'd left Prague, they didn't have them back then, and I rang it, and he said, it is true, it's some bad theatre.
He's dying then?
He's dying. And he said, and now I will tell you, I could not tell you when you were here, but I loved you and I always loved you, but it was too hard to say that. You were always going to go back to Australia. And he died not long after that, and Yada rang me, and he gave me this story about him. He said, this is what Kardel was like. We were on a tram coming back from a party. Back in the old days, the tram, they had those night trams and they wandered their way through all the suburbs. And Kardel was telling a joke about, you know, a Russian minister and a Czech minister and all the workers. Very good soldiers, fake-ish story. And people were laughing so much that they stayed on the tram, didn't get off at their stops, went right through to the end. And Yada said they'd never met Kardel before in their lives. So that really summed him up. He was the Pied Piper.
When he said he didn't believe in love, what was his phrase?
Love is for nothing.
Love is for nothing. Do you now think he really meant that, or was it just a way of making it easier to let you go, to let you go back to Australia so that you could stay in Prague? What do you think now?
I think that now. At the time, I thought he believed it, which was entirely credible given what he'd been through, what the Czechs had been through. But now I think he did it as a way of also letting me go.
Do you think he was right about never being able to leave home? Because that's an alarming thought to me.
Mm.
I don't know what I think about this. I don't think we should stay where we're born. I don't really think we need to. But then, I know that's true for you maybe, and it's true for him as well.
Well, no, it's so interesting because he said to me, why are you when I first met him, what are you doing travelling all around the world on your own? Why aren't you at home? We Czechs do not leave home. And it's true, the majority of Czechs grow up and live where they've grown up and never, ever move. Very few Czechs travel. But they're the Czechs of the generation who couldn't. Things are different now. People are travelling. I have spent my whole life travelling. Because like most Australians, it was a rite of passage for us if we were lucky enough to go to uni or we wanted to see the outside world because we'd grown up with stories of, you know, the mother country. It's normalny, as I'd say, for Australians to travel. It was not normalny for Czechs. So he couldn't understand and it was not something he could do. but I've lived in so many places. But I've now done the full circle and living now back in Alice Springs, which I was not sure I'd ever do, having lived in so many places. And I probably will not be there forever either, but at this point in time, I'm very glad to be back in that red centre.
And what is home for you now? What is your home like in Alice?
So I live just by the Todd River, this magnificent, wide, dry riverbed full of white ghost gums. Behind me are the towering McDonald Ranges. I look out my window and there are beautiful mulga cassia bushes full of yellow flowers. There's this enormous range just on the other side where you can go walking, wildflowers everywhere, huge blue skies and these skies of stars. And I haven't been back living in that world for a long time, and it's how I could write my three memoirs. I wasn't able to write them until I went back and put my feet back on the earth, and then they just flowed.
It's been fascinating speaking with you, Tanya, and such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. I've loved it.
Tanya Heaslip is the author of several memoirs, including Alice to Prague and Alice Girl and Beyond Alice. Today's conversation with Tanya Heaslip was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. The producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.